Teaching English Today, The Four Seas and Beyond by Louise Carlton-Gertsch is powered by Ernst Klett Sprachen, der Verlag für modernes Fremdsprachenlernen in Schule, Ausbildung, Universität und Erwachsenenbildung. Sprachenlernen fürs Leben.
Hello and welcome to Teaching English Today, The Four Seas and Beyond. A podcast in which we'll be looking at ways to help students of English develop important skills for the 21st century. I'm your host, Louise Carlton-Gertsch. So today I'm joined by Katharina Wendrich, an English, French and psychology teacher at the Anne Frank Gymnasium in Bavaria. And it's great to have you here today.
Thank you.
It's very exciting to have somebody who also comes from a psychological perspective. But perhaps before we begin to dive in, it would be important to know what a story is. So how are we going to maybe define story when we're talking today? Now, I was looking at different dictionary definitions, and they often revolve around a story being an account of an imaginary or real people and events that are told for entertainment. And while that's a nice definition, I think I'd like to go a bit deeper. I like the definition by Jonathan Gottschalk, who wrote The Storytelling Animal, who describes them as being problem-solution structures, because this means that stories involve listeners in a struggle, and it creates deeper involvement and, importantly, engages people emotionally. I think this is, at least for me, what storytelling is about. But what about you, from a psychological point of view? What do you think are the important parts of storytelling, and why?
Well, I completely agree with you and Gottschalk, actually, because there is an emotional involvement as soon as you listen to a story, as soon as you consume a story in, well, wherever you find it, whether it be online or in everyday communication. And I think that's because as soon as we hear a story, for example, we automatically contrast it with the way that we think about, you know, certain, well, everyday encounters, the way that we also make decisions, and we automatically question our own, well, attitudes, I think, whenever we're confronted with stories. And that's why it's true that we are emotionally involved, because we do, well, we're forced to come to a conclusion at some point and to decide whether the way that we've handled things before was the right one, or whether maybe that would be a different perspective that is just as valid today. So that's why storytelling certainly is about your own individual background story too.
That's a very interesting point, actually. So you, kind of like each story we listen to, everybody's going to be listening to it from a different perspective.
Exactly.
Because they're bringing their own kind of background into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, Margaret Atwood, that we're never going to kill storytelling because it's built in the human plan. We come with it. And it's something we've been doing all our lives, isn't it? Well, actually, it's something human beings have been doing ever since they've existed.
Mm-hmm.
But I often think that they have a particularly important role for children and for young people. And as a teacher, you must experience this on a day-to-day basis. Why are they so important?
I think they're mostly important because children and teenagers also, they're still in that process of finding out who they are and of defining their own identity, more or less. And I think that stories, whether they tell them or consume them, help them, constantly modify and then also come to terms with who they are. And so I think that by consuming stories, for example, like I said earlier, they are confronted with various perspectives and ways of thinking and automatically have to adapt constantly. And then at a certain point, they'll probably find out who they are, more or less, and they'll stick with that version of themselves if they're comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And then also by telling stories, they get to shape the way that they're perceived by others. And they get to, well, find out what are those people's reactions to the way they present themselves. And that's also what gives them feedback every single day. And then I think depending on that feedback, again, you try to become somebody else in every tiny little detail. So to say, well, I don't know, the way that you react to pictures, for example, or the way that you present yourself when it comes to the information that you publish online, or whether you tell a certain story about an event that occurred last weekend, and then you decide to hide another one that you maybe find too embarrassing suddenly. So, And I think that's how storytelling will always be important for children and teenagers. I think it's just the kind of story that they're looking for that changes over the years. But storytelling in itself will always be an essential part of their lives, I believe.
That's an interesting point. When you're saying the kind of stories they're looking for changes, can you give me an example of that?
Well, I'd say that younger children are mostly looking for stories that inspire their imagination. So that's why they also tend to be interested in mythical creatures and all sorts of non-human beings that possess powers and abilities that we don't have, because it allows them to, I don't know, well, to play a certain role probably, and to just imagine that they could be part of a very different life. A life very different from one that they're actually leading. And then teenagers, I think they mostly tend towards stories that are about ordinary, authentic people that are forced to cope with challenges that everyday life confronts them with, just as they are, and that make mistakes, and that also can't always hide their weaknesses, just as we can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that teenagers are mostly looking for stories that are about main characters that they can actually identify with. And smaller children, maybe they focus more on entertainment, or maybe just about on fun also. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the older they get, they see another kind of relevance and significance in stories.
Does this affect where young people access stories? Because, I mean, today, people access stories in a whole range of settings, don't they? I mean, it's yes. In the past, we would read books. Of course, today, this has changed dramatically. Where do your students interact with stories? So passively, if you like, interact with them rather than actively tell them.
I think that they interact with them, well, still in literature as well, if they're, as long as they're interested in books, but mostly on social media, probably, because that's where they're constantly being confronted with people who try to present themselves in a certain way. And I think you can't really get away from that, because we all depend on social media and other forms of communication that we're just stuck with today. And that we also, well, want to consume, of course. It's not just something that's happening to us, but it's also something that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. So I think it's mostly social networks and messengers and those kinds of things where we find stories nowadays, and where teenagers are looking for stories.
And that's probably where they're also telling stories as well, isn't it?
Yes. In general, I think we're talking about a whole other kind of story mm-hmm. when we focus on social media. I think it's not really about that traditional story where you've got a beginning and an ending, and then, mm-hmm. you know, that mountain structure and all those things. But I think it's about presenting identities and personal lives, and also presenting personalities, maybe. I think those are the kinds of stories that they produce mostly nowadays.
So social media has really, in many ways, changed the way that we tell certain stories.
Absolutely. I think it has.
When your students post on social media, to what extent would they class them as stories? I mean, we all know that when you post on Instagram, you have your story. So they're going to call them a story. But to what extent do they really think of this as a story?
That's a very interesting question, because actually I think that sometimes they're not really aware of producing stories, so to say, but I think they still do it, and they still use those techniques because they want to do that, right? It's not a coincidence. It's still a very deliberate decision to publish certain things about yourself. And I think when they go online, for example, to publish one of those stories on Instagram, they do that because they want to have a certain effect on those that are looking at their profiles. They want them to know that they're really happy, that they're spending a great day with their family, for example, that they're in general very interesting people, because they've got this one really particular hobby that is so special that nobody else could share it with them. And maybe they also do it for admiration, for all kinds of things that all human beings are looking for, if we're honest. Mm-hmm. And so that way, I think they do probably, they constantly tell stories, but I'm not sure whether they actually know that they're doing it.
So they're not necessarily crafting a story, as in other situations where we really want them to craft stories. That mm-hmm. perhaps it's more crafting it more unconsciously.
Yeah, maybe.
To their own advantage.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. Yes, because I don't think that they necessarily think about the consequences of what they put online. I don't think that they always realize, well, if I put this picture up, the reaction is going to be, I don't know, people liking my posts or people being excited about them or maybe even surprised by them. But I think they think of their own reaction. Mm-hmm. If somebody else had put these kind of contents online, what would be my personal reaction? And then they draw their consequences from that. And then they think, well, I'm going to reach the same effect if I produce content like that. That's my theory. I don't know if it's true, though.
But it's a very, very interesting theory and actually sounds extremely plausible. Yeah. So what we're also seeing here is, of course, the need to be thinking very much about what you're doing, what you're posting. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, this is something that I think people, not just young people, because I don't want to do young people bashing, but I think people in general do not think carefully enough. Mm-hmm. We don't think what we're doing. I mean, we all know that on social media, stories are being told to manipulate people. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible platform for getting people to really try and think the way you do. It can be very dangerous. How does this affect the way you deal with this in the classroom? Because I think this must be a very important aspect of what you do with older students, especially.
It is. I think it is our responsibility to look at, for example, social media profiles that might be misleading. So just to show them some examples of people who, I don't know, are constructing this ideal world around them and publishing all those very, very positive contents every day. And then ask your students, well, what is the effect that this or that post has on you? And is there a certain possibility that maybe that is not the whole truth that you're seeing? And how do you recognize something that's not true, that's too crafted, so to say? And then make them think about things that, well, if you take a closer look, don't seem too plausible after all. Mm-hmm. For example, those perfectly constructed, like I said, happy pictures and those people that get out of bed in the morning looking just as if they had woken up after, you know, I don't know, a great party, but still look just as fresh, just as before the party. And all those things that we're supposed to believe, but shouldn't. And this also leads to political questions and all kinds of areas where you need to be careful. So I do think that we should address that with our students in the classroom and maybe even get them to think about those things by coming up with their own ideas. So whenever you talk about, for example, Shakespeare or another author, you could always have them think of the way that they will behave online if they had the possibility today, and then also wonder about the effects that they might achieve. Mm-hmm. Well, if I post this picture instead of the other one, is everybody going to think about me? And how can I shape their opinion of me and their perception of me, even if maybe I'm not always telling the absolute truth? Mm-hmm. And I think it's a mixture of confronting them with things that you find online and also having them try out certain things. And then in the end, probably they'll reach a sort of competence or sensitivity, at least, maybe even some sort of vigilance when it comes to the contents that they consume. And that would be the ideal goal, probably.
Wonderful. And I like when you're talking about doing it through literature, because I can imagine that for students, it's a very personal thing, isn't it?
Is.
All of what we're doing on social media. And so if we can say that, you know, get them to step into somebody else's shoes and do it from the perspective of a character in a book or a film or whatever, it means it's not so personal. So they're perhaps more likely to want to go down that road. Whereas if you talk about it from their own perspective, I certainly wouldn't want to do that.
Exactly.
That would be too personal.
But then actually sometimes discussions like those do encourage them to tell the fellow classmates and the teacher about experiences that they've had online. So that's also what I've experienced with students that suddenly come up and tell me about mistakes that they've made online, and they've just realized that this or that was wrong and that they rather shouldn't have done it. And then they tell me that was an interesting exercise, and in the future they will probably be more careful about certain things that about a certain behavior online. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a rather rare experience that I'm talking about here, but it does happen.
So, I mean, this is great because it's getting them to be much more critical mm-hmm. about what they're posting themselves without having to come with the kind of more or less this kind of telling them, and you have to be careful. But this self-revelation, rather, is so much more important.
Yes, exactly.
What do you do in the classroom to raise awareness with your older students about the dangers of storytelling? I mean, that's one side of the dangers of storytelling. As we know, you mentioned before about the political issue. Mm-hmm. To what extent? I mean, we're coming up to 2024, probably a new UK election, definitely a new US election next year. Everyone's going to be going wild on social media. What can you do to help students become more aware of these kind of things online?
So actually, I think that most of our students are already way more competent when it comes to judging fake news, for example, recognizing fake news also. So I think that's something that would probably have to be part of our lessons regularly. Mm-hmm. A discussion about how to find out what's true and what isn't, and checking your sources and all those tips that you give them. But then also, again, I personally use all sorts of examples also taken from literature and other areas of foreign language teaching to get them to think about the kind of information that they find also published by political parties. Because there again, you can, for example, look at one story being told from different perspectives or in different ways using different techniques, and then have them look at the differences in perception that are caused by those techniques, by that choice of techniques. For example, let me just refer back to Shakespeare again. Uh-huh. You know that there's a lot of Shakespeare merchandise. So for example, when you talk about Romeo and Juliet, you've got the original text, but then you've also got the manga version and you've got the Star Wars version. And there's all kinds of versions of that one story. And then you have them read those different versions, let's say three different versions, and look at the differences between them. So in the cartoon, certain pictures were chosen. In the speech bubbles, certain parts of the text were chosen to be used, and others, just had to be dropped, of course, for lack of space. And how does this change the way that you perceive that one story that still remains the same, basically? And then you go from that to, okay, so we've got an event that has taken place, and there's two politicians talking about it in front of the camera. One of them chooses these words, one of them chooses these kinds of information, whereas the other one goes down a very different path. How do you react to version A and version B of that one same story about that one same event? And I'm hoping for them to realize then that there's a huge power of manipulation, of course, but not only in a negative way, actually. That comes down to choice of words and voice modulation and, gestures and facial expressions and all sorts of nonverbal signals that have to be taken into account as well. And I'm hoping for them to come to that conclusion in the end where they say, okay, maybe sometimes it's a really handy strategy to compare various versions of that one account in order to find out which one is the one that I find most believable, incredible, and most well researched, and which one to actually believe, to follow.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point, because if we go back to the origins of storytelling, it is an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And of course, the great storytellers, even the great storytellers today, are very good at knowing when to pause or to speed up or how to use hand gestures, as you say. So it's very important that students are made aware of this too when they're telling their stories, because it can make everything... It can undermine a good story if your hand gestures or your physical gestures don't actually support the story.
And also, once they know about those things, they're able to use that knowledge to their own benefit when it comes to presenting themselves in, oral exams and all sorts of contexts like that. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Of course, storytelling is a very effective form of communication. It's probably the most effective form we have. Also about selling oneself, isn't it? It's about selling ideas.
Yes.
I mean, one of my favorite quotes is Carmen Gallo, who writes in The Storyteller's Secret, "The ability to sell our ideas in the form of story is more important than ever because they're the currency of the 21st century." And he talks about the fact that we're only as valuable as our ideas. And it's the way that how we package these ideas with emotion, with content and relevancy, that is going to be a really valuable skill in the future. And this is one of the things that I wonder with students at times. of course, to be able to do so, I have to know my audience. And often it's very easy to think about the message I want to give, but I forget about the people I'm trying to give the message to. So this is probably another very important aspect, as you were saying before, about understanding the person you're talking to and how to present something so that you can emotionally connect with them. How do you do that?
Well, you would probably have to focus on the different contexts. So, for example, if I prepare my students for an oral exam, as in the A-levels, for example, I would give them different instructions than I would give them for, I don't know, a presentation of some sort of creative exercise just in the classroom during during the lesson. And I would probably also have them wonder, first of all, about what the jury, I'm just going to call them the jury, is going to expect them to do. So I ask them, so I'm sitting in front of you. It's your very last day of English with me, and you're supposed to present to me, I don't know, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, what you know about it. What am I going to expect you to do? And then they tell me, well, you probably want to know if we know about all the details in the story. And then I say, well, you should go a little bit further than that, shouldn't you? And then they go, well, you'd probably want us to be understanding the connections between Shakespeare's private life and his works or something. And then I'd go, yeah, that's correct also. But I also want you to do, and then I'd tell them what I expect from them. And then I give them some sort of an insight into, well, the way I evaluate their performance. So in the end, we've got this list of things that they should be looking for, that they should be focusing on also. And then we do trial runs, basically. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, this is a very, well, this is a very clear environment. It's me that I'm sitting in front of them. They know me as a teacher. They've known me for 2 years at least. And they know what I'm expecting them to do. But it's way more difficult to do with an audience that you don't know. That's mm-hmm. for sure. And then in that case, I think I'd recommend for them to focus on things that we all have in common. So human needs, you know, that you should try and fulfill. I think that everybody's looking for some sort of admiration, appraisal, acceptance, those things, you know, that we also look for on social media, actually. And then I have them appeal to those needs. You know, I don't know if you know what I mean, right. But I'm trying to get them to change perspectives and to, well, take the role of the examiner, of the person sitting in front of them, in order to understand what kind of behavior will be expected from them.
I think that's very, very important, because we need to engage on an emotional level. And so if we're not aware of what the other people are actually waiting to find out and what they need, then we can't do this.
Yes, exactly.
So this is also, of course, very key when they're doing presentations, or for instance, if they were doing an elevator pitch or something like this, because they've got this split, maybe 20 seconds to explain to somebody who they are and to get their idea across. And if they don't anticipate this, what the person actually needs and wants to hear and can't communicate emotionally, this isn't going to work. Still, I think to a certain extent, this is something we expect students to do automatically. And I think at times we need to help them to craft ideas into a meaningful story, mm-hmm. perhaps more. Is that something that you feel as well? Or is that something that you think, no, it's kind of in our genes, we know how to do this kind of thing?
No, I actually absolutely agree. I think that is some sort of skill that needs to be trained first through the years. There are certain, well, I think it always depends on your personality and kind of your personal background. Some of us find it really easy to practice storytelling because it comes natural to them. But I think in other cases, it's something that you really have to learn how to do. And I think there are certain strategies that we can teach our students in order for them to feel more secure also in front of an audience. And then, of course, that is something that we need to focus on more than we're doing it right at the moment, because I think sometimes when we talk about storytelling, that one thought that always comes to our minds is, oh, creative writing and creative exercises. And how do we evaluate that? And how does that work? And like, what's the point? It's not part of the A-levels. So why would we practice it? You know? And I think we need to get away from that focus on the kinds of exercises that are important for our final exams and that will... I don't know, help them score points, you know. We have to focus on everyday life skills that they're actually going to need. Those, I think we called them soft skills in the past, yeah. I think. I don't know whether they're still called soft skills, to be honest. But that's the kind of thing that we need to focus on if we want them to be successful, and mostly if we want them to stand out, because that's what you said earlier. There is this huge, well, there's such a huge amount of sources where we can find information and also provide information today. And then it's those that know how to appeal to our human needs. It's those who know how to involve us emotionally that will actually be successful in the end.
Absolutely. I think, and especially as we move more towards a world that is also being infiltrated, I'm going to use that word very consciously, with artificial intelligence, this is where we will find that we have our advantages, because we can connect on an emotional level. Interestingly, storytelling as well, it has been picked up very much in the field of marketing. And it's used quite aggressively in the field of marketing and branding campaigns today. I mean, you were talking about it in the field of social media before, how we brand and market ourselves. Mm-hmm. But it's also very important, of course, when we're trying to sell things, because people have realized, it's much better to sell something if I can create an emotional connection. Mm-hmm. To what extent do you incorporate these kind of aspects as well into your teaching?
Well, when we look at those social media profiles that I mentioned earlier, for example, we also focus on the way that influencers use social media in order to sell products, most more or less, because I think that the two aspects that you've just mentioned are intertwined. So selling yourself and selling a product, they're always linked to each other, maybe more so today than in the past, because we are now used to connecting certain products to people that we admire and that we would like to imitate in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that person tells me that that product is great to have and it helps me be a little bit more like them, I'm more encouraged to buy it. And I think that's why with our students, we need to be looking at all sorts of advertisements online and commercials also, and analyzing them also in all the tiny little details that they're constructed of. So colors and sounds and choice of words and everything that contributes to that, well, to our perception, to the effect that those commercials have on us, and make them wonder how the message that is coming across would change if we modified, I don't know, like I said, the choice of colors and choice of words and all those things. And I think in doing so, we provide them with the knowledge and with certain skills that they're going to need if in the future they want to be able to tell a good ad from a bad one, and mm-hmm. if they want to, well, be able to tell whenever they're being manipulated and also acting upon that revelation, so to say.
Okay, that's interesting. And I think, as you say, extremely important. Do you think storytelling is an effective form of communication? So not just reading and consuming, because we often think of storytelling as doing literature in the classroom, but mm-hmm. also actively creating. And as you said before, not just actively writing a story, but doing all of these other activities that you're doing. Do you mm-hmm. think this is being addressed enough in the classroom?
I don't think it is, to be honest, because mostly if, well, say, we pitched this idea to fellow colleagues, they would probably say, well, there's not enough time. Mm-hmm. And they're not wrong about that. It's true that there is a lot to do and there's not enough time to teach all sorts of, well, competences that we would like to see in the children or teenagers by the end of their school career. But still, I think we should incorporate some elements in every lesson, like mm-hmm. Some ritual at the beginning of the lesson, maybe, where somebody tells us a story. It can be a report on politics. It can be also some personal story, for example, about, well, things that you've done over the weekend. And then give each other mutual feedback, like tell each other mm-hmm. what was the effect of what you just told me, what's my emotional response to this, and could you have done it differently to involve me even more? So I think that mutual feedback is not very popular nowadays, because we always associate it with negative feedback and mm-hmm. with being criticized or mocked even. But actually, it's a very, very handy thing to do, because it gives you a certain impression of, well, what you said earlier, the way that we are perceived by others and the way that we want to be perceived. And then maybe well, it also tells us whether there's certain details that we could still improve. And that's why I think we need to get back to a certain feedback culture, if that term mm-hmm. exists, where we actually value that, where we appreciate feedback also. And maybe that would be a helpful way, or well, a sensitive way also to include storytelling in our everyday classroom.
I think that's such an important point, because especially also when we go out into the workplace, we are going to be living in this feedback culture. And if we can also help students to learn this positive feedback, how to make others feel good about giving feedback, it can still be, if you like, negative in inverted commas, but it can be couched in a positive way, then we're going to all become better givers of feedback.
I agree.
And we won't have to try and learn it when we all go out into the big wide world. Thank you so much, Katharina. It's been wonderful talking to you today.
Thank you very much.
It's been really interesting getting your insights as to how this is done in the classroom. And good luck with all of your endeavours, and keep up the amazing work.
Thanks for joining me. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Teaching English Today, The Four C's and Beyond by Louise Carlton-Gerch was brought to you by Ernst Klett Sprachen, der Verlag für modernes Fremdsprachenlernen in Schule, Ausbildung, Universität und Erwachsenenbildung. Sprachenlernen fürs Leben.